Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. A few weeks ago, I was listening to the Great Courses, and there was a wonderful grammar boot camp where the professor went through something like 24 different lectures on all kinds of grammar rules and the background behind them to help us speak and write better. You sound like you talk differently. You know, there's always those little grammar rules that pop up. And I do not want to be one of those people. And I don't like those people who always correct other people on their grammar. I mean, sometimes it's okay to do for a person's edification, but a lot of times it can come off as annoying and you earn the label the grammar Nazi. Now, that's a term I'm not a big fan of, grammar Nazi, because the Nazis did horrible, awful things. And so just because somebody cares a lot about grammar doesn't mean they're committed to genocide or white supremacy. One shouldn't combine the terms there. Yes, the Nazis are very strict individuals. So there's nothing wrong with being strict or understanding rules and applying them. And so I like the term in this Great Courses work that I listened to. Instead of grammar Nazi, I liked grammando. Is somebody the grammar commando or the grammando, someone who cares about grammar and wants to apply it correctly. And of course, you can go too far with that. So what I wanted to do today was just talk about common grammar rules and how some people can think that they're actually more universal or more inflexible than they really are, because grammar changes over time. But just because grammar changes, the other extreme is to say that there's no rules whatsoever, so I ain't gonna care about how I speak to other people. There are rules related to grammar, and we need them to be able to communicate our ideas. I'm grateful, for example, to the editors that work on my books and my Catholic Answers magazine online articles, so the articles and books that I write. As the author, I'm blind to the faults in my work. That's why with the rise of things like self-publishing, you're seeing a lot more works that are going out into the public square that don't sound very good because they haven't been edited. That when you create a work of art, whether it's writing, music, whatever it may be, you have a hard time seeing the flaws because you care about this thing that you created. It's kind of like how parents think more highly of their kids than other people do, except for my children. I know my children are beloved by everybody, but that's what happens with their own written work. So it's great to have an editor. That's why I love having Todd Aglioloro, for example, the director of the Catholic Answers Press here at Catholic Answers. He edits some of my books, and sometimes he really takes me to task, but I appreciate it because it helps me to become a better writer and a better public speaker. So with that, let us speak about different kinds of grammar rules that exist, how they're violated, and what we can do to be clearer in our presentations to others. The first stop I want to take you is Star Trek. So this is the intro to Star Trek: The Next Generation, though the script is the same as in earlier Star Trek series. Let's go into, I want you to listen to this and listen to what is being said, all right? With an ear for grammar.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
All right. Did you catch the error here? Unfortunately, Captain Jean-Luc Picard, he split the infinitive. So you've probably heard this. If you think about a list of grammar rules, you remember the rules your English teacher taught you. They probably said to you, never split an infinitive. And what most people say when they recall back on the rule and reflect upon it, oh, don't split an infinitive. What's an infinitive? Well, I don't exactly know, but I just know you're never supposed to split it. An infinitive is just a two-word form of a verb. So you think of the verb to cook, to read, to study, to be. It's the infinitive, the most basic way of describing that verb. You don't have any tenses attached to it. And so instead of cooking or cooked or running or ran, of course, there's irregular verbs that will come up. You just have the infinitive, so to cook, to run, to study. And so in Star Trek, you have to seek out new life, to explore strange new worlds, to boldly go. So that's a split infinitive. And so the correct term would be to go boldly. But that actually reveals that the rule for the split infinitive is not a universal rule. You may have been taught that this is just an unbreakable rule, and if you split an infinitive, you're going to go to grammar jail, or I guess a grammar concentration camp if you like grammar Nazi lingo, which of course I do not, as I just said. So splitting the infinitive is not a hard and fast rule. It would sound weird to say to go boldly to where no one has gone before. To boldly go sounds a lot better there. The American Heritage Dictionary has a usage panel, and it was great in this course that I was listening to in the great courses. This woman was a member of the usage panel, and they're linguists, authors, writers, public speakers who sit down and vote on what grammar is and isn't acceptable. It's not a science to it. It changes over time. So the usage panel was split 50-50 about whether this sentence was acceptable. I expect him to completely and utterly fail. The correct would be, I expect him to fail completely and utterly. But I like putting completely and utterly. I like the split infinitive here. But the majority of them were against this sentence. We are seeking a plan to gradually, systematically, and economically relieve the burden. Most grammarians would say, no, it should be, we are seeking a plan to relieve the burden gradually, systematically, and economically. And I'm in favor of that. When you split an infinitive and put too many things before the word to and the verb, you lose the meaning. So I see where the split infinitive, that rule, can make sense. You just have to see what sounds right and is the meaning being preserved. A special example, though, of a way to split an infinitive that is not controversial is the word not. I learned to not provoke Sally, lest I be on her bad side. So that would be weird. I learned to provoke not Sally. You'd say no. Excuse me there. We just put the word not in there to split the infinitive that way, so it's fine. All right, rule number two, the singular they. This is controversial. Here's the sentence. When a person crosses the street, blank should look both ways. When a person crosses the street, should look both ways. Who should look both ways? When a person crosses the street, he should look both ways. That's traditionally how you would define it, though many people want to put the word there, the singular version of they or them. When a person crosses the street, they should look both ways. In my writing, when I usually write, I am more open now to the singular they than I was in the past. And I do think that it's making a comeback. And in many cases, though, when you're trying to preserve the singular pronoun, I'll put a he in there because it's fine. I'm not some kind of sexist pig. I'm talking about one person, one generic person doing something. He works fine in these situations. I don't like when a person crosses the street, he or she should look both ways. Or when a person crosses the street, he, she should look both ways. That's terrible. I will take singular they over he or she any day of the week. But then the problem with just using the generic he over the singular they is that you have sentences like this. I'd like to thank the anonymous reviewer for blank review. Because if I say I'd like to thank the anonymous reviewer for his review, what if it's a woman? Then it just gets kind of awkward. There, I feel really compelled in that kind of sentence to say, I'd like to thank the anonymous reviewer for their review. And this is not some kind of newfangled grammar invention, by the way. You go back to the works of Jane Austen in Mansfield Park. She has this sentence. Had the doctor been contented to take my dining tables as anybody in their senses would have done, so not as anybody in his senses would have done, but Jane Austen writes, the doctor been contented to take my dining tables as anybody in their senses. So the singular they has actually a very long history in English grammar, and I don't see the problem bringing it back. It also kind of helps with the pronoun controversy dealing with transgender ideology. Someone who is a biological man goes by a woman and demands to be called her or she. That's not true. I refuse to say those pronouns because I'd be communicating a lie. If the singular they, though, I think works fine in this situation, that it helps to communicate the idea I'm talking about a person doing something, and I'm just not weighing in on whether they're a man or a woman. Other examples of grammar issues that come up in writing are fake words, fake news, fake words. Well, they're words. They're real. Almost always they are real. You'll find them in the dictionary, but with a definition saying they're not real words, but they're used commonly. Here's an example. Irregardless, we should still pay attention to what our teacher is saying. You know, our teacher is droning on, but irregardless, we should pay attention to what she's saying. You just say, our teacher is droning on, but regardless, we should pay attention to what she's saying. Irregardless, to me, is the quintessential example of a word that's not a word. You know, it's kind of like flammable and inflammable. I don't know why we have both words. They mean the same thing. But irregardless is really not a word. Don't use it. It's regardless. Just use that. Another word that's similar, a friend of mine asked for help, actually, in writing a letter. And she was asking for help. She was working on a letter. And it had the word impactful in it. And I said to her, impactful is not a word. And she looked it up and said, it is a word. And she read it and it says to have a great impact. And I said, keep reading the definitions. And the third definition of impactful said, a word that is looked down upon by more educated writers as being generic or bland. I think it came impactful was coined in the 1960s by advertising executives. Don't worry, Chief, this ad is going to be impactful for our listeners. That's more of a 1940s person. 1960s would be a groovier person, I imagine. So try to avoid fake or redundant words, impactful, irregardless. Here's the next rule. Less or fewer. So is it less or is it fewer? Is it 15 items or less in this aisle or 15 items or fewer? Traditionally, it's 15 items or fewer in the grocery line, not 15 items or less. I remember there was one grammarian, maybe it was Fowler, who said that this is like the beginning of the end of the English language happened in the grocery store supermarket with the 15 items or less aisle. Fewer deals with discrete countable things or countable nouns, while less deals with non-discrete things. So the rule is you use fewer if you're talking about a set of things that you can count one by one. Bobby has fewer M&Ms than Freddy. You use less for non-discrete things. Like you can count M&Ms, one M&M, two M&M, three M&M, four M&M. Am I making you hungry yet? But you wouldn't say Bobby has fewer juice than Freddy. You can't count juice. You don't have one juice, two juice, three juice. You could say fewer juice boxes, fewer milliliters of juice. But juice, you just can't count. Or you might say, this car holds fewer gallons of gas. This tank holds fewer gallons, but it holds less gas. So fewer is when you are counting a set of things and each one is countable. Less is with non-discrete things, like liquids are a good example of that, or gases that aren't discrete. So less and fewer is used in that way. So really, it should be, this aisle is for 15 items or fewer. Lie versus lay. This is a hard one. So here, this is, let me play this song by Eric Clapton, Lay Down Sally, so you remember it. So here's Eric Clapton's song, Lay Down Sally.
Won't you make yourself at home and stay with me? And don't you ever leave? Lay down, Sally, and rest here in my arms. Don't you think you want someone to talk to?
Now, actually, it should be lie down, Sally. Lie is something that you and I do. The word lie does not require an object in the sentence. I lie down. Sally lies down. I lie down. It's what you do. Lay down is what you do to other people or things. So what Clapton is really meaning, he doesn't want Sally to leave. So he's saying, you know, hey, lay down, Sally, don't leave. But really, that'd be more like telling other people to lay down Sally, like Sally is an unconscious woman or something. And so he's telling like his friend Bob, you know, lay down Sally, I don't want her to leave. Like he's just taking her lifeless body and putting it on the couch. So it has a lot more of a grim tone to it when you put lay down Sally instead of lie down Sally. So lie does not require a direct object. Lie is what you do. Lay is what you do to other things. Where it gets tricky is this. What is the past tense of lie? When I did that act, I lie down, how I described doing it yesterday. The past tense of lie is lay. That's where it gets really confusing. So it's not I lied down this morning. Lied is the past tense of the word lie when you're talking about deceiving others or telling falsehoods. But when you come to putting yourself reclining, the past tense of lie is not lied, it's lay. I lay down this morning. I laid down this morning, because laid is the past tense of lay. Lie is what I do to me. Lay is what is done to other things. I lay down last night, but I laid out my clothes for the business trip the next day. So lie versus lay. So just remember, when it comes to lie versus lay, Eric Clapton was wrong. It's not lay down, Sally. It's lie down, Sally, if you or I do it. Next, IE versus EG. You might see in a sentence, IE or EG as abbreviations, and some people think that they mean the same thing. They don't. IE is Latin for id est, which means that is. It's talking about a specific identifier for something, whereas EG is exempli gratia. More Italian, but it's all kind of in there. EG is exempla gratia. It means for example. So that can be one of many different examples. Here's the sentences. I ran into the love of my life, i.e. my wife. So for me, I have only one love of my life, my wife. I wouldn't say I ran into the love of my life, e.g. my wife, because that would imply I have other loves in my life that are running around out there, and I happen to just run into one of them who's my wife. Not the case. I ran into the love of my wife, ran into the love of my life, i.e. my wife. But if I say, there are a lot of great women in the world, e.g. my wife, that there are a lot of great women in the world. If I'm talking to a guy who says, I can't meet any great ladies out there, there's no good Catholic women for me to meet, I'll say, hey, there's a lot of great Catholic women out there. For example, my wife. Now, you can't have her, buddy, but the point is, it's not an extinct species. They are out there. I.e., that is a specific identifier, e.g., for example, one among many within a set. Next example, when do you use further or farther? The difference here is metaphorical and literal. So Bobby ran farther than Freddie. That would be a literal distance, that you're going farther down the road. Further would be, let's think this to a further degree. Further, let's continue this problem further. That is more of a metaphorical sense of traversing distance. Or at least, I really hope that I'm getting this right. I'm waiting. I am not infallible when it comes to grammar, by the way. I'm not infallible. Free for All Fridays, I share what little knowledge I have, and I hope it helps you. I think that I have that right. It's a 50-50 on here. If I get it wrong, if I'm making more grammar mistakes, and honestly, I'm probably making grammar mistakes as I'm talking to you. There is a difference between speaking and writing. Sometimes I've thought about taking transcripts of the podcast to turn into maybe an article, to share with others. I can't do it, because if you listen, I speak in a way that is far different from how I write. There's overlap for sure, but the way you and I speak to one another, it's so different from how we write or how we should formally write. So grammar is looser, it's more flexible when we're dealing with speaking to one another versus when we're writing. That has to be taken into account. So if I get something wrong, because I'm speaking more informally here, do go to trendhornpodcast.com, leave a comment under this episode. Always nice to hear. And if there's other grammar rules I did not come across in this episode, you can list them there as well. Here's the next one. Between versus among. When do you use between and when do you use among? Between deals with two things that are in comparison. Among would deal with many separate things. So when I say I ran between the kids, that makes you imagine there are two kids and I've threaded the needle, I've run between them. Or Indiana Jones drove the boat between the ships. There's a famous scene in Last Crusade where he's with Ilsa and they're trying to get away from the bad guys. And he's like, don't go between them. Are you crazy? And she's like, go between them. Are you crazy? And they go between two ships that are being pushed together. So they go between the ships, not among the ships. Among would be if you're scattered about. So if I ran among the kids, It's like there's a bunch of them in the field and I'm just like weaving about. There's not just two. Between deals with two distinct things. Among, you have many things. Here's another rule that people often, they don't think it through. They write the sentence and abandon it and don't realize they've made a rather humorous error. And this one is the dangling modifier. So the dangling modifier occurs when you include a clause that modifies a subject in a sentence, but it's misplaced. Here's the classic example. Hanging from the trees, Bobby saw the monkeys at the zoo. Hanging from the trees, Bobby saw the monkeys at the zoo. And I want to say, hey, Bobby, get down from the trees up there. Because that, you know, that's what it's saying. You're hanging from the trees, comma, is modifying. It's misplaced. What we mean is Bobby saw the monkeys at the zoo hanging from the trees. So Bobby saw the monkeys at the zoo hanging from the trees. It modifies the monkeys, not Bobby. The problem is, I think dangling modifiers come up a lot because people want to write in a way to impress others. And it sounds more impressive to start with this clause instead of with the subject of the sentence. Hanging from the trees, it's like you're entering into the sentence more dramatically. So, but that leads to bad writing. If you wanted to do this, you'd have to write, hanging from the trees, the monkeys were seen by Bobby. But the problem here is that you've corrected the dangling modifier, but at the cost of inserting the passive voice. And as Strunk and White say in their Elements of Style, the passive voice is to be avoided. We covered this in a writing episode, I think, you know, several months ago. The passive voice is to be avoided. Avoid the passive voice. The passive voice adds unnecessary words and it makes your writing rather clunky. So for the dangling modifier, watch out when you include phrases like hanging from the trees or clinging to the tank. Susie saw the octopus. Susie isn't clinging from the tank. The octopus is. Watch out for that when you have ing words at the beginning of a sentence like that. While versus whereas. This is one I've actually made a mistake a lot in my earlier writing, and Todd does a good job of fixing me on it. While deals with comparing things that are occurring at the same time. While is a comparison, whereas is a contrasting word. So if I say, I worked on the playhouse while Laura watched the kids, what that means is I was working in the garage on the playhouse, and at the same time, Laura was watching the kids. We're a delightful domestic unit. Whereas is a contrasting word. I worked on the playhouse, whereas Laura watched the kids. So that is a sense more to contrast that Laura did not work on the playhouse. Maybe she said, why don't you do that and I'll watch the kids. So sometimes what I see, at least has happened in my own writing, I overuse while instead of whereas. So if you say the sentence, Frank likes pizza while Bobby likes pasta. It's not like we're saying Frank is liking pizza here and Bobby's liking pasta here, and guess what, they're doing it at the same time. That's not the essence of our sentence. What we mean is Frank likes pizza whereas Bobby likes pasta. If you want to contrast something, use whereas. If you're trying to make a similar comparison, then while might be more appropriate. Here's the next one. Who or whom? Who or whom? When is it okay to use who? When is it okay to use whom? Here, I need to use a clip from season 4, episode 7 of The Office. This is a scene where Michael is trying to do a PowerPoint presentation in the office, and he's been up late because he has a second job. He's out of money. He's working a second job. He's up late. He didn't get his presentation done, and Ryan is really angry at him. And so they're having this conversation, you know, Michael, why didn't you get the presentation done? You can't have this other job. It's affecting your work. That's the setting, and now here's the conversation they have.
How long until you actually get this presentation ready?
Why don't you honest do the presentation?
Because I don't want...
you know how to do
what
it.
What I really want, honestly, Michael, is for you to know it so that you can communicate it to the people here, to your clients, to whomever.
Okay.
What?
It's whoever, not whomever.
No, it's whomever.
No, whomever is never actually right.
Well, sometimes it's right.
Michael is right. It's a made-up word used to trick students.
No. Actually, whomever is the formal version of the word.
Obviously, it's a real word, but I don't know when to use it correctly.
Not a native speaker.
I know what's right, but I'm not going to say.
because you're all jerks who didn't come see my band last night.
Do you really know which one is correct?
I don't know.
It's whom when it's the object of the sentence and who when is the subject.
That sounds right.
Well, it sounds right, but is it?
How did Ryan use it as an object?
As an object.
Ryan used me as an object.
Is he right about the...
How did he use it again?
It was... Ryan wanted Michael, the subject, to explain the computer system, the object.
Thank you.
To whomever, meaning us, the indirect object, which is the correct usage of the word.
No one asked you anything ever, so whomever's name is Toby, why don't you take a letter opener and stick it in your skull? Hey, this doesn't matter.
See, I love The Office because you've got multiple jokes played on here in rapid-fire succession. This is a throwback to our comedy episode that I did a while back. But my favorite lines are, Oscar, I'm not really sure how to use this. He's the Hispanic, the self-identified gay Hispanic accountant in The Office. And Michael, you know, he says, I don't know how to do this. Michael, not a native speaker. And then Mindy Kaling's character, Kelly, is used to date Ryan, is trying to make him jealous in this scene. So it's like, did Ryan use it as an object? Ryan used me as an object. And then, of course, we have Toby and Michael, who, you know, Michael hates Toby because Toby puts the kibosh on all his crazy schemes. So when do you use who or whom? Pam was correct here. Who is when it is the subject of the sentence. Whom is when it is the object. So, for example, who said the play was over? Tom said the play was over, not whom said the play was over. The rule here is that if you can, you use who if the pronoun in response is he. Who are you, you know, who said the play was over? Tom said it was over, or he said that it was over. So if the pronoun in response is he, you would use who or whoever. But when it's him or her, you would use whom or whomever. It refers to the object. Whom are you looking for? I'm looking for Tom. I'm looking for him. So who when it is referring to the subject, and whom when you're referring to the object of the sentence or the indirect object of the sentence. Here's another one. Fun. Can you say, well, here, let's try this. Mike's party was more fun than Joe's. That sounds right. Mike's party was funner than Joe's. Can you say funner? Or here's the one that really gets people. Mike's party was the most fun. Mike's party was the funnest. Mike was the funnest person. It sounds wrong, right? A lot of people say you can't say funner or funnest. But here is where you get into the controversy about the word fun. That in common usage, fun appears to be both a noun and an adjective. That traditionally, fun was a noun like pizza. I had fun at the party. I had pizza at the party. So you couldn't be funner or funnest, just like you can't be pizza-er or pizza-est. It's a noun. But now, more and more, fun is being used as an adjective. And if it's used as an adjective, I don't see the problem in saying funner or funnest. I think it's a prejudice against the words, because we say... Mike was thinner than Joe. So Mike can be thinner than Joe, but Mike's party can't be funner than Joe's. Mike was the thinnest person in class. Mike was the funnest person in class. If you can use thin, thinner, or thinnest, I think you should be able to use fun, funner, or funnest. So I think that that is more than appropriate to include there. Let's see if we have any other, the last sentence, the last rule, and this is a rule that everyone always seems to forget. They literally don't know what they're talking about in that they misuse the word literally. The word literally, just means something as it really is. I am literally sitting here recording a podcast for you. Most people, when they use the word literally, they mean virtually or figuratively. So you might say, you know, I have literally a million things to do today. No, no, no. You have virtually a million things to do today, or figuratively a million things to do today, in that I have a lot of things to do. So, hey, that was a lot of fun with you all. I hope I gave you a few grammar tips here. Definitely check out Strunk and White's Elements of Style. It's not an infallible rule book, but does give some great tips to improve your grammar, your writing, your speaking, so we can clearly communicate ideas and the truth, especially God's truth, to people who need to hear it. Thank you all so much for being here today. Have a blessed weekend, everybody.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.